On this episode of Video Culture, we'll talk atomic bombs with Fat Man and Little Boy and the Manhattan Project. Bombs away!
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast. In a place where everyone has an opinion. Two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And thank you for joining another adventure, another episode of Video Culture. This is your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And this week is our Bombs Away episode, as you like to call it.
Yeah, it's a little bit flippant for a pretty serious subject matter. But how else? But you know, we can't be too serious here. If it's too serious, it's not fun. And we strive to have fun here.
Yeah, it is true. We try to have fun with the show. Although you're correct, this is probably some of the heaviest subjects that we've ever tried to tackle or to talk about, really. Mm-hmm. We know that, you know, atomic bombs were dropped, you know, to end, World War II in Japan, and, mass destruction and lives were lost. And it's very sad tale of, you know, of just man's destruction and war. And so we have multiple ways to kind of tell that story. And these are two movies, I think, that really try to attempt at, trying to show us the seriousness. Although one is kind of a dramatization kind of Oppenheimer and, you know, that operation. And then another one is really kind of exploring this, you know, this duality of, you know, our happy home life and then this other thing that we have to have in the background for, you know, for defense.
Yeah. So often, the idea of nuclear war has been a fertile ground for movies. And it's rare that you see real serious takes on it. A lot of times they're kind of exploitive or they're more fanciful.
Mm-hmm.
But I think these movies kind of show the spectrum of that, because Fat Man and Little Boy attempts to be a serious dramatization of the actual Manhattan Project, where the atomic bomb was created. And mm-hmm. then the movie called The Manhattan Project is really more of an adventure story, in a way, that takes elements from The Manhattan Project and makes kind of crafts like a War Games-esque sort of scenario around it.
Yeah.
Like it's sort of a little bit like War Games, a little bit like Real Genius.
Yeah.
And it's all very 80s.
It is.
But it's very kind of, it's a little bit serious, but it's also kind of light.
Mm-hmm.
And this shows the way that movies kind of can be used to show two very different types of the same sort of concept. One is really in very serious, one is sort of, you know, fanciful.
Well, I think one of it is like, what can the scientists sort of accomplish, right? And, you know, pushing the boundaries of science and what is possible with a lot of these like unknown things that are like so dangerous, like how close to the edge can you get? And then, you know, because you also have all these problems, and then because it takes a team of a team of scientists to solve some of these problems. And then it's like, you know, what are we building for? Because, the grand old question is, you know, scientists never stop to ask, you know, what, what we could do, or they never stopped to ask why. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
well, what's that line from Jurassic Park? You were so busy concerned with if you could, you never stopped to think of if you should.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I think that's kind of unfair because I think the scientists knew. The gravity of that, and some of them, had more opposition to it. But anyway, we'll get into that.
I think that leads us pretty well into what Fat Man and Little Boy is actually about.
So. Yeah. So just a quick synopsis: Fat Man and Little Boy. It was a film made in 1989, and it stars Paul Newman and Dwight Schultz, and also John Cusack. But the synopsis. In real life, Robert Oppenheimer was the scientific head of the Manhattan Project, the secret wartime project in New Mexico, where the first atomic bombs were designed and built. General Leslie Groves was an overall command of it. This film reenacts the project with an emphasis on their relationship, written by Anonymous. And obviously it's trying to, draw these parallels between the actual names of the bombs, which is Fat Man and Little Boy, to... the general, which I assume is like Fat Man, General Leslie Groves, and Little Boy, which is, Oppenheimer, which is played by Dwight Schultz.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this is really trying to be a prestige picture. Like, it's got big name actors. Obviously, it's a very expensive movie. It's got a Morricone score, who's a famous composer. He wrote the themes for The Good and the Bad and the Ugly. Yeah. And it's obvious it's a big picture. You can tell they really wanted it to be like a big awards winning type of film.
Well, this was a Paramount film, and which is funny because I think at this time, I don't think Paramount was bought out by a Japanese company, but either which way, because it was 89 at that time, but. You could tell they were going for Oscar nods, right?
Yeah, that's what they were going for. I think they missed the mark, but yeah. Let's get into it.
Oh, yeah. I think they missed the mark by a lot. Also stars Bonnie Bedelia, which mm-hmm. our audiences know as Holly from Die Hard.
Yep, and it stars Laura Dern.
Yeah, Laura Dern.
She of many David Lynch movies, and a guy that you and I like a lot, John C. McGinley, who seems to pop up in a lot of these things.
I saw him. He just plays like the buddy pal who's, always your smiling, fun to hang around with. Yeah.
Yeah, like he's going to make you laugh, but he seems to just pop up in these 80s and 90s films. Like, he has an amazing career. He really does.
He really does. Because when I first, saw him on Scrubs, you see him and you're like, I've seen him before, but you really don't know from where. And it's from all these, parts like this.
And apparently it's from every 80s and 90s movie.
Yeah. I mean, he's in Wall Street. He's in Fat Man and Little Boy. Yeah. As these like sidekick characters, I think it's really funny.
Like, he just pops up and adds life to whatever he's in, and doesn't really do. He's there for like lightheartedness in all these films.
Yeah, not lightheartedness funny, but just kind of lightheartedness and heartwarming. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He doesn't really. That's why I thought it was funny on Scrubs. How he always just kind of plays like the sarcastic jerk. But yeah, he definitely is a. Most of his other characters, I think, were sort of cast differently. But I think that. His Scrubs character more shows like, sort of his range. You know what I mean? Is sort of really, how some actors like that can get kind of pigeonholed into doing certain things, but really they can branch out and do a lot more if given the opportunity. And sometimes it takes television to do that. You know what I mean? So
yeah, and it's clear. I mean, he's one of the highlights of this film. Let's get into it from the beginning. The general is played by the great Paul Newman. He assembles these scientists together to basically build an atomic bomb to hopefully end the world war. One of the scientists is played by John Cusack, who's kind of like the kind of wide-eyed, aw shucks, youthful guy, and
he's just like a Midwestern. Scientist graduate, You could tell he was the one that went to, you know, this prestigious college because he got a scholarship, not because his parents had a lot of money, you know, because he was actually really smart.
Yeah, like he's kind of the everyman, yeah. And he's sort of in awe of Oppenheimer, played by Schultz. But really, and this is where the movie kind of falls apart to me, and I wish we'll get into it. The movie really focuses a lot on Newman's character of the general.
Yeah,
and he is an intensely unlikable character.
He is. I mean, Groves definitely was like an unlike general. I mean, there's no secrets that he, you know, had run-ins with Eisenhower, even where Eisenhower, like, you know, chewed him out for being too harsh and always trying to one up, you know, the other generals and stuff like that for a promotion, you know, like always bucking for a promotion kind of guy, always trying to make himself look good, always trying to prop himself up, always trying to, you know, yell and just put pressure on below, you know, from people below to get, you know, results. So it's not like, you know, him, he, you know, his, you know, philosophy of being a general is I'm going to light the fires underneath them and, you know, kind of remove the blinders so that they can only focus on what they got ahead, because, you know, he wanted to, you know, he you get from the very beginning, you know, you hear an argument that he wanted to be, you know, out at war. He wanted to, you know, be like Patton, basically, and you know, be out leading soldiers, not leading scientists. And
what he was skilled at was basically leading engineers.
Right, exactly. But yeah, it just, and there's this, you know, kind of struggle between, you know, we need to get this done, and the scientists, you know, like, well, we have to figure it out. You know what I mean? Like, we can't just, we can't just like produce what you want to produce. You know what I mean? And so, so yeah, there's that struggle. But yeah, and to me, it's not a very much of an interesting struggle. The more interesting thing to me is how the scientists really sort of came up with tackling these problems. But yeah, that in itself is not, doesn't make for really great cinema, I don't think.
Well, and the parts when they focus on their breakthroughs are interesting, but it's all glossed over pretty quickly. And so much of the film is spent with Paul Newman really bullying the other characters.
Yeah.
And he spends a lot of time bullying and threatening Schultz's Oppenheimer. And Oppenheimer is not a very sympathetic character either. I mean, he's cheating on his wife. He is arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie focuses so much time on those characters and really shortchanges the likable characters, which are John Cusack and Laura Dern.
Laura Dern, yeah.
Like, I think there's an interesting movie that you could make out of this where they are the focal point. Everything else kind of happens in the background. And it's the tragedy of their love and their romance while all this other stuff is going on.
Yeah.
But that's not really the movie they were interested in making. Those elements are there, but those are backgrounded for the General and Oppenheimer story. And those two characters, again, are just so, again, not likable. They're not even really that interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And we spend so much time with them.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, like the final scene between the two of them is like, you know, like they just give kind of each other a thumbs up. Like, okay, yeah, we finally got it done. But really, like the more, you know, heartfelt characters between like Laura Dern and, you know, John Cusack, they just kind of, you know, fade away. I mean, I don't know. I agree with you. I think that they tried to do too much. They tried to tackle too many things at once and try to, you know, jump around, because there's all these underlying things underneath. You know, there's, you know, Oppenheimer's, you know, affair. There's the security. There's the scientific problems that they had. There's, you know, John Cusack and his love interest in the, you know, this doctor-nurse relationship that he's, you know, hoping not to step on. And you know, there's the scientific question of, you know, the moral question that the scientists start to bring up, but, you know, and it's just,
And there's the stuff with the general basically hiding details so they keep working on the project. Like he's basically covering things up so they keep working on it, which is factual. I mean, that happened.
Yeah.
But the movie throws all this stuff at you, and it doesn't really focus on any one thing, again, other than Paul Newman being this grouchy general and Schultz being this kind of moody scientist, while, again, the likable characters are really shortchanged.
Yeah. And I just want to say, every time Paul Newman talked, it was like, Doc Hudson from Cars, because that's what he sounded like. That's what I heard. I'm like, oh my God. Because, I mean, you have to remember, I mean, Paul Newman was like really old, and he's probably a lot older than Groves actually was, you know, at this time. And he just has that gravelly voice, and, you know, he just tried to carry this like big, you know, bold presence. And I agree with you. I just don't think it was that, you know, that interesting. And the thing that got to me the most was the dialogue between all of the characters. Like, I'm like, nobody really even talks like this. Like, no, I think there was a conversation between like Groves and Oppenheimer's wife. And, you know, when a time that Groves came over to, like, you know, see him at his house, and I'm like, what the heck are they? It's like they're talking in code or something.
Yeah, like, no, nobody talks like that ever.
No.
And not even in the 40s. No one spoke that kind of coded and eloquently and really kind of arch. Like, it didn't feel like people speaking.
Mm-mm.
It felt like a writer who was really pleased with his own dialogue, and I mean, maybe that's being harsh.
Yeah, I agree. It's like, oh yeah, that sounds great. It looks great on paper. I mean, it's so romantic, and so just, I don't know what the words to describe it are. It's just a little bit too much. Like they're trying to, you know, write Shakespeare type of dialogue in this, you know, historical dramatization, you know, reenactment, you know.
Yeah, the best sort of writing when it comes to dialogue is writing that feels natural, so you don't think about it being dialogue as it's being said. You just think of it as characters talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And this the entire time you can almost see the typewriter keys clicking as the characters are talking.
Yeah,
it's just not good.
Yeah,
and again, I mentioned the Morricone score. I was so excited when I saw his name. I'm like, oh, I love his stuff, and I think it's the worst score I've ever heard from him. It's not memorable. There's not one good theme in the entire film. I was surprised how much. Like, I was kind of indifferent to watching it to begin with,
mm-hmm.
but I was surprised how much I actively disliked it.
It goes a lot, it floats between hard military, just like standard military. I mean, in the military stuff that he wrote that's there, it's like, I think I heard a similar type of thing in like Short Circuit or something like that when, you know, they're all, the government's kind of coming over the hill. You know, there's like snare drum and the dun, 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 you know, and it's, and then these like, really soft, you know, like, very like, sort like of these, like floating these, melody, you know,
these,
floating.
These tinkling melodies, yeah.
Yeah, like you're in a cloud. I'm like, what is happening?
Yeah, it's honestly, like I said, I think it's the worst thing I've ever heard from him, and that really surprised me.
I mean, it's recorded well. It sounds great. But yeah like the actual essence of it doesn't really capture you for sure. I was really kind of put off by, and this is the first time I ever say this, you probably never hear me say much of this, but there were so many opportunities for such great scenery and cinematography, and I just don't think that it was there.
I mean, I agree.
A beautiful place, and we only see just like a couple of shots and scenes of it.
It looked like a really expensive television movie.
Yeah.
It really did. Like, I mean, it looks like they had all the money in the world, but they had a guy who was used to shooting TV. And I don't really know much about the guy who directed the film, But it had no, like, flair or, like, an eye for interesting, like, composition or a way to capture the nice scenery that they were obviously in. Everything was just shot kind of unremarkably.
Yeah.
The only thing that's even remotely interesting is the scene where they fire off where they do the test at the end.
Yeah.
And you only see the test in the reflection of the goggles of the people watching it. That's the only visually interesting thing in the entire movie.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's the last, what, 5 minutes of the movie?
Yeah, like the last thing. Yeah, and you can tell they got one of those big, like, super fans to, like, blow in, like, Schultz's mouth, you know, until it, like, looks all, like, really cool. And
it sort of looked like Closer by Nine Inch Nails. Remember that video?
Yes, yes, that's exactly what I was thinking about, yeah. Because he's wearing the goggles just like that. He's wearing those goggles and... Yeah.
That's immediately what I thought of, man. John Cusack, of course, when they focus on him, and Laura Dern, that stuff's good.
Yeah, like the stuff that he wrote in his book where he's like trying to, you know, all those letters and stuff like that he was going to send to his dad. And there was parts of it that he... would kind of like self-dialogue or whatever about it. But those were very sort of fleeting moments. Like I don't really think that we got enough of that.
Yeah, it felt like there were multiple drafts of the movie. And there's a draft out there somewhere where he was the one who narrated the entire film. And it got rewritten so much where they forgot to take all that out. So it's only there sporadically. So sometimes sometimes it feels like he's the main character who's kind of framing everything.
Yeah.
But then other times you don't see him for like 30 minutes.
Yeah, but it's almost like you're watching, you know, this story from three people's eyes. You know what I mean? You're watching it from, you know, General Groves, you're watching it from Schultz, and you're watching it from Merriman, which is John Cusack. It's like those are the three people that you were following. And it's just, I don't know, it's never, the one between Groves and Oppenheimer gets bored very quickly, and, you know, and then we just don't get enough of Merriman, basically.
Yeah, like, it felt like they were so enamored that they got the great Paul Newman, that they made him the focus of the film, and really that was such a fundamental mistake.
Yeah.
Because, again, he's not interesting, he's not likable, and he's in so much of the movie as the focus.
Yeah.
Very,
very, very true.
So the
good parts about it, though. Come on, we have to say something good about it.
Yeah. I was going to get to that. So we, as we always talk about, as we've been doing this new thing on our show, fast forward, rewind. What part of this would you fast forward through?
I would fast forward through, like, those awkward, very tense, like, conversations that they would have. Like, especially between, like, Oppenheimer and his, you know, girlfriend, you know, Groves and, you know, Kitty Oppenheimer, you know, those type of things that, like, you're just like, what is going on? I have no idea. Like, this is just silly. And, I would definitely just skip that part.
Like, I don't know what's happening. I don't know if I really care. Yeah.
Yeah.
I completely agree. So what part would you rewind and watch over again? What's really the bright spot for you?
The scene where, I mean, I think two of the parts I find, like, most interesting about this movie. The scene where, like, Merriman is going through that experiment and, you know, injures himself. That to me is incredibly, incredibly fascinating about the core and about the radiation. And every time I think about this movie, I think about that scene. And it's just like, how did that happen? How did that happen again? What was he doing? What sort of readings was he getting? Why was he messing with the core with, like, screwdrivers? And, you know, it's just, it's hard to watch because you know it's going to happen, but it's also... I also find it very fascinating, because it actually, it did actually happen for real. It didn't actually happen like before this, but I'll talk about it, later. But yeah, it actually, what Merriman did, in getting sort of like poisoned or you know, by the core, by radiation, a similar accident actually happened like that about a year later.
Yeah, and see, to me, in a better film that focused on his character and Laura Dern, that would be kind of like the pivotal moment where everything kind of goes bad and it becomes a tragedy.
Yeah,
because that scene is really well done, and you know, he has the thing where he tells everyone to get out, and he's doing the calculation to see who's going to be safe and who's not, and he realizes everyone's going to be okay, but him.
Yeah,
and that's that realization that no matter what he does, he's going to die, and see that's interesting stuff.
And when he takes those like shaking breaths, you're just like, gosh, I mean, seriously, I can't do that, you know. I don't consider myself like an actor, but I mean, you could just tell that there's fear in his eyes, and you could feel it, and you can hear it, and yeah, it's an amazing scene.
Yeah, like again, Cusack is great, and he's really good in it, but he's pushed to the background so much, and yeah. He really shouldn't have been. It should have been his movie.
Yeah, I agree.
His and Laura Dern's. So I definitely agree with you. Really, any of the scenes with him and Laura Dern and John C. McGinley as like they're like yeah. pal.
Yeah, because you see John Cusack, and then you get to meet like as soon as they get to Los Alamos, like, and you see them kind of meet each other in this like really kind of you know, hilarious way where they drop the refrigerator and you know, break the stairs, and it's just yeah. like then it just like that relationship stops and you don't see it for another, you know, 20 minutes later down in the movie, you know, just like, what? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but every time they're on the screen, up until the tragedy happens, the movie gets lighter and more enjoyable and interesting, and it's just, there's not enough of it. I feel like there's a good, like, 90-minute version of this movie that where they are the main characters, and Paul Newman and Dwight Schultz are kind of background characters. They sort of kind of loom over the story, but aren't the focus.
Yeah.
So yeah, I agree. If I could savor any moment about this movie, it would be the scenes with Laura Dern, John Cusack, and John C. McGinley with his pet monkey.
With his pet monkey, yeah.
Yeah, that's what we didn't mention was John C. McGinley is the base doctor, yeah. And he has a pet monkey for some reason. And
well, no, he has a lot of animals because they're doing some sort of testing, or they wanted them there for testing. So, but he just kind of makes friends with the monkey. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but who doesn't love a monkey? You know, monkeys yeah. make everything better.
Of course.
But yeah, did not enjoy it.
Yeah, did not enjoy. Okay, so let's move on to the Manhattan Project. So this was a movie that I thought was a lot more popular than it was because they showed it on HBO like a lot in the 80s, and I saw it a lot, and I thought it was fascinating that this kid, well, I'll just go over the synopsis. A high school prodigy builds an atomic bomb with stolen plutonium to win the 45th National Science Fair and expose a nuclear weapons lab posing as nuclear medicine in Ithaca, New York. Now, I think it was not plutonium. I thought it was uranium.
I'm not sure.
I can't remember. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
I always think of plutonium because wasn't that what Doc Brown stole in Back to the Future?
Yeah. Sister? Yeah.
What I always think of. But I'm going to go ahead and admit something to you right now, Ryan. I thought I had seen parts of this movie before.
Uh-huh.
Once I started it, I realized I had not, and I had confused it with another movie called... I confused it with another science fiction film from the 80s called My Science Project, which is a totally different film. But when I was watching this, I was like, I don't remember this at all. And that's why.
Ah, okay. Well, I think HBO used to like call it My Manhattan Project instead of The Manhattan Project, because I think people would see it listed and then they would think, oh, this is going to be about the Manhattan Project. And it was about this kid building an atomic bomb for a science fair, and they're like, wait a second, this is in the 80s, this is current day, like, what's going on? So that's why they call it, like, I think HBO secretly, like, renamed it on their, that's what I remember, but I could be wrong, I don't remember. Because if you call it My Manhattan Project, then it sounds more realistic to what this story actually is.
It is a better title, for sure, I think. But we do know from past episodes that HBO did kind of mess with films that they showed sometimes back then. They would show edited versions or change versions at different times of the day. So it's not outside the realm of possibility that they could have altered the title.
Well, and then when it was released on video, it was released on HBO Video. So there you go.
That's what I do want to bring up before we get too far into it. This is kind of, you can't find this film streaming. If you want to see it, guys, after hearing us talk about it, your options are VHS, Laserdisc, DVD, and a Blu-ray came out of this film about 4 years ago. So those are your only ways to see the Manhattan Project. If you want to check it out after we talk about it.
And it's not
streaming anywhere.
And it's not very expensive. Just because it's, rare and not streaming anywhere doesn't mean that, it's going to cost you, $50 to buy the DVD. I mean, it's pretty standard price.
Even the Blu-ray was like $15. I mean, it's out there and it's easy to find.
Right. So, the cast in this movie, Christopher Collette plays the student that builds the bomb. His name is Paul. His character's name is Paul Stevens. John Lithgow plays the sort of the head scientist at this lab. His character's name is John Mathewson. And, they move into town to produce this, like, high-end, plutonium. Like, he gets a government contract to, like, produce this stuff. And, Christopher Collette kind of, finds out about it and wants to, do something about it.
Yeah, so I was going to say that our listeners might know Christopher Collette from, he was in a few pretty popular cult films. He was in the horror film Sleepaway Camp 1 and 2. He was also in Prayer for the Roller Boys, which are, those are two pretty popular, like, culty, or three pretty popular cult films. He wasn't in a lot of other big-name stuff besides that and those and this. Mm-hmm. The whole movie, to me, has kind of a real genius, sort of Ferris Bueller, kind of War Games-y vibe to it.
Like, yeah.
He's meant to be, like, kind of smarter than everyone else. Right. And he knows he's smarter than everyone else.
Right.
And to me, it makes him a little unlikable.
Yeah, I mean, he's smart, like, but you see him in the classroom, like, pulling pranks on people, in the classroom or whatever, because that's what makes him popular, because he's kind of a goofball. Even though that he's smart, he's still, and the teachers don't like him. Because he is smart and he's not, sort of like taking advantage of it or like using his brain for, what he should or whatever.
Yeah. It was definitely a thing in the 80s where for some reason, Hollywood screenwriters often thought cool young characters had to be smug. Have you ever thought about that? Like, again, like Ferris Bueller or the lead character of Real Genius.
Val Kilmer's character.
They tend to be kind of arrogant. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why they confuse arrogance with being cool.
Yeah. That were I know it's like a 90s, but like Van Wilder or something like that. Like,
so that the kind of the 90s equivalent is that for sure.
Yeah.
But just like, again, kind of, full of themselves.
I don't think Lightman from War Games was that full of himself, but he was like kind of unsure and a lot more nerdy, and he kind of more played the part like he doesn't know how to talk to girls, and we can talk about that later. But
that's why War Games is a better movie. But
but the film really was. It was part of a whole cycle of films about like atomic bombs and the Red Scare. Of China or not China, Russia, in the 80s, like War Games, the China Syndrome, the Atomic Cafe, Silkwood, Testament, Threads, Red Dawn, The Day After, which The Day After also stars John Lithgow.
Yeah.
So it's just, to me, I think this is a little more interesting, like, sort of subject to study, you know, the sort of like the post-war, like the post-atomic, like now we have atomic weapons, now what we do with them. And it really, if you want to understand the idea of what, you know, detente is, then you can watch this film and you'll have a complete understanding. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's what the film does well, for sure. Because, I mean, it's definitely a better film than Fat Man and Little Boy. Because at least the characters have redeeming qualities. One thing I really liked about it was, pardon me,
mm-hmm.
was that John Lithgow is actually a pretty likable character for the most part.
Well,
you know, he's not a stereotypical villain, at least.
Yeah. Okay. So imagine me, like, being, you know, however 10 years old, 12 years old, watching this movie over and over, and, like, think about all the other movies that John Lithgow was in, right? Like, what are some other, like, outlandish movies that he was in? He was in
Raising Kane and The Great Ricochet, which I wrote about for the website. You know, yeah. Harry and the Hendersons, you know.
Well, not really Harry and the Hendersons. But he was in the one that we watched, where he played.
Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, yeah.
Right.
He played a lot of villain roles, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And what was it, Jacob's Ladder, he was in, you know. And it's like, that was his thing. But then I watched The Manhattan Project, and he's like kind of a father figure in this movie. And I'm like, that's how I got to know John Lithgow. I thought, oh, that's how he is. And then to like see some of his other films, I'm like, you know, and besides Harry and the Hendersons, which I think kind of follows this, but more of a, you know, that same sort of fatherly thing where he plays like a dad. But yeah, it's like completely different, you know, completely different guy.
Yeah, he's got way more range than anyone has ever given him credit for. He's really great. I mean, I am a huge John Lithgow fan, and going back over some of his old work because of the show and the website has really reaffirmed to me how great he is.
Right, because a lot of people and a lot of audience, you know, probably knows him more for, you know, being in, you know, the TV show Third Rock from the Sun, you know, where he's like, you know, super outlandish alien, you know, guy.
It's all like goofy, wacky comedy, and he was a really good dramatic actor.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of gets glossed over when people talk about him nowadays.
Right. But yeah, he's in this, you know, he's super, super calm, super mild-mannered, just like super collected, and, you know, you really, even though that he's not really the bad guy, but you're kind of on his side, and you're kind of on, you know, the character Paul Stevens' side as well. Yeah. And so it kind of shows like both sides of it. Now, also starring, I have to mention, it stars a very young Cynthia Nixon, which, you know, a lot of you guys know her from Sex and the City, you know, and here she is as a teenager. You know, who has a thing for Paul, you know, yeah. Jenny has
I was gonna say, it also has, John Mahoney, and he was in Frasier. He played Frasier's father.
Yep.
On that sitcom.
Yeah. And but also, yeah. And also to connect the two movies also starred with, you know, John Cusack and Say Anything.
You're right. You know, that's a good call out.
Yeah.
But to go back to what you're saying about how the story is structured, that's one thing I really appreciated about Manhattan Project was how it's pretty nuanced in the way it handles our two main characters of John Lithgow and Paul. Because either one could have been the villain in the film, and they're really not. It's more nuanced than that.
Yeah, and I
really liked that. I would say I really respected that because it could have been way more obvious and way more exploitive, and it went for something that was gentler, and that part really surprised me.
Yeah, and because you don't really know like where it's going. Like I've seen it, and I know where it was going, but like as it got towards the end of the movie, I was sitting there watching, going, you know what? I'm going to pretend that I haven't seen this. Like, I don't know how it's going to end. And, you know, because it had been a while, but I know exactly how it ended. But I was just like, just watching it, you know, trying to watch it with as fresh eyes as possible. And, yeah, you're kind of like, when it gets close to the end, you're like, I don't know how this is going to end. I mean, because basically what happens is, like, they have the, you know, he builds this atomic bomb device, you know, for a science fair. And then because he wants, you know, the people to ask, well, where did you get the plutonium? Well, I got it from this plant that's up near my house that they have not told any of the town they you know, that of what they're doing up here. And, yeah, you know, trying to expose this lab or whatever.
Yeah, it's very much a kid's egotistical plan.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, and, you know, how did you know that this was going to happen? You don't think that they were going to know that, you know, they were going to find out, you know, eventually that they're missing some plutonium or whatever.
Yeah, like the government's not going to freak out immediately when they find out and try to kill you.
Exactly. And, yeah, so, and then he winds up, like, taking it to the science fair, but then after that, like, escaping and some other people there. Kind of some other participants of the science fair hear what's going on, and then they escape. Him and Jenny, Cynthia Nixon, escape to go back to town, and then going back to the lab. And then, like, in a note of, like, you know, heroics, like, you know, John Lithgow's character, John Matthewson, you know, he decides that he's going to tempt fate because, you know, you know, Paul Stevens, you know, he's like, I don't know if I could go through with it, you know? And so John Lithgow realizes that, oh, whoever holds the bomb holds the power. So he's like, okay, so I'm going to threaten, and then you're going to back off, you know? But the thing
he wants the kid to get out. He likes the kid. He likes the kid's mom, and he wants them to be okay and safe.
Right.
You know?
And, you know, but then the bomb decides that the timer's going to go off by itself because the, you know, the radioactivity just, like, threw the timing circuit off.
That's another thing I really liked about the movie was it actually played with the idea of that this kid didn't make a perfect bomb. The bomb had a lot of flaws in it. Mm-hmm. So the minute they try to do anything with it, you know, things go really bad pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I thought that was a nice touch.
Well, and I thought, too, like, even... you know, John Lithgow, like John Matthewson, like his character, he, as they're looking at it, he's fascinated by it. He's fascinated that this kid could build this thing. And he's like, oh, what'd you build the reflector out of? You know, it's like,
yeah,
like how ingenious is this kid, you know, that, and he's still, yeah, you know, enthralled by him.
Yeah. I mean, it's clever and it's interesting, but it's not perfect, which I appreciated, you know. It wasn't like this amazingly crafted thing. It was kind of janky in places, which was a detail that they didn't have to include, but I thought went a long way for making it feel kind of real, giving it some stakes.
Right, and then they all had to, but yeah, John Matthewson, you know, he has to outsmart, you know, all the stuff and figure out the circuit and figure out how to defuse the bomb. At like the last, you know, last few seconds or whatever.
Well, yeah, because it's a movie. You got to get down to like the wire where you gotta have the wire cutting scene and stuff like this, you know.
Yeah.
And the way the film handles it is pretty creative. Really, the last 20 minutes of it are really quite great.
Yeah.
I mean, you have good acting from all the leads. It's a good bit of tension.
Yeah.
It's a well done sequence. So.
Yeah.
You know, I thought the movie. I liked the movie. Okay. What really took me out of it was I found the lead character, Paul, to be just generally unlikable.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted Lithgow to catch him. I wanted the government to catch him because I didn't really like the character very much.
Yeah.
And to me that hurt the film. When you don't care about the protagonist, and when they want you to care about the protagonist but you don't, that really hurts a film. And it hurt this film to me.
Yeah, and the fact that he's a, you know, this bratty kid, you know, had he been just like a smart scientist and then just did it, you know, you know, not just to spite, you know what I mean? Just kind
Yeah, not that it just to prove how smart he is and to be smug about it, you know?
Yeah.
Which really, that's his entire motivation, is to be smug. It really is.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, I'm not exaggerating. I mean, that's really his entire character motivation.
I guess I never really looked that deep into it when I was a kid. I just really just thought it was, you know, funny.
That's just me looking at it through my old, you know, middle-aged man eyes. Like this little punk bastard.
No, I don't disagree with you. I just, you know, younger, I did not think about that. I think you're right. I mean, I can see that. I can see your argument. And I guess I didn't. I still probably don't think about it that much. I was like, oh, okay. Because to me, it's kind of like a scientist, kind of like, you know, kind of like Sheldon Cooper or something like that, who does stuff without thinking about it, you know, just to like prove a point or something like that. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And like clearly, it's made for audiences who are that character's age, who are like 16 and 17. And I don't know. Going back and watching it now as the middle-aged man I am, it plays very differently for me, where I find, you know, old John Lithgow to be way more sympathetic.
You know, I thought it was funny, though, that just to kind of tie the two movies together, that you have, you know, in Fat Man and Little Boy, you had like the two, you know, sort of main characters sort of at each other. And in this movie, too, you have this two sort of things, the two characters sort of at each other. But it's more like the military, like, we want this to happen, and then like the people, like, we want this to happen. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm, yeah. People going, we want to live in peace, and then the military going, well, we need, you know, protection. Like, you know, John Lithgow's kind of playing this sort of like, you know, you need us on that wall, you know, kind of character. You know what I mean? Yeah. And
I think that's
not John Lithgow. That's John Mahoney. I'm sorry, John Mahoney. Yeah. playing as the military. The general, yeah, playing the Lieutenant Colonel Conroy. Trying to, you know, get this kid down or whatever, you know, he's playing the character that's, you know, you need us on that wall. Like, and he's trying to convince, you know, John Matheson, like, hey, what do you think you're doing out here? What do you think, you're just playing around? Like, this is all for, you know, you're one of us. You're on our team.
Yeah, I think in these kind of films about nuclear devices and war, there's an underlying vibe of distrusting the government. Because, I mean, it's all, when it comes down to it, there was no reason for these things to ever exist. That's one of the points of Fat Man and Little Boy, was that there was no point for these bombs to ever have been finished. Yeah. The idea of nuclear deterrence is a falsehood. It's really damaged our culture, it's damaged our society. You know, thousands of people have died because of it.
Yeah.
And it's made our world exponentially less safe,
right?
And I think those kind of feelings of wariness and unease seep into all these kinds of films, because that's part of what it is when you live in a world where you know that at any moment, if something goes wrong, we could all just be wiped out, and that's really the world we live in nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. You know, but yeah, I think it goes back to, you know, where Paul Stevens is kind of cornered, and everybody's trying to, you know, all the guys can't get a clear shot, and he's just kind of stuck there, and he's kind of like, well, what do I do? You know, he's pinned down, but his only defense is to blow up everybody, including himself, and, you know, that's kind of like the deterrent, right? So, but it's not really winning, you know, and I think that sort of idea is really played out, you know, like in War Games, you know, the whole movie is about that part, about, you know, and I know it starts off like a kid just stumbles upon this, like, you know, computer or whatever, and it's more about computers, but then turns into this whole thing about, you know, defense and all this other kind of stuff. And that's this similar idea here. You know, how it's just started off as like a little game, a little prank, and then just kind of gets out of control. But
the only way to win really is to choose pacifism. And that's kind of a hippy dippy, you know, peace, love, and understanding kind of idea. But the only way to survive is to just to be peaceful, and I think that's one of the other undercurrents of at least this film, and definitely War Games.
Yeah.
But yeah, for the most part, I thought the Manhattan Project was pretty good. So, but to kind of keep it going, if you were gonna skip over any part of some, if you were gonna fast forward through any part of the Manhattan Project, what would it be, Ryan?
The whole scene where they're trying to get back from New York to, you know, back to Ithaca. I mean, I know it's a fun, campy scene when they're on the bus and
I'm gonna say the same thing.
It's completely unneeded.
Well, and they meet the other kids at the science fair, and these kids are like castoffs from Revenge of the Nerds. Like it's like they waltzed in from another movie.
Yeah.
And the kids help them escape, and it's just like the whole tone of the movie suddenly changes for like 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I completely agree. That entire scene, I don't know how you would get them back to their hometown, but I hated the way they did that. I hated those characters. I hated that whole escape sequence.
Yeah.
Just, it was jarring. It was out of place. And I hated all those
characters. And it was unexpected. Like, you're like, you don't even know what's going on. Like, you're not even included on the plan because you're watching, you know, through Paul's eyes or whatever, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
And then why go back to Ithaca? Why go back home? Like, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's at that point, I mean, the last 20 minutes may go back up for it, but when they get there, that part's interesting. But the idea of why they would go back and what their plan is doesn't really make sense.
Right. And
it's awkward.
Yeah, and then Paul's like drugged, so he's acting weak, you know what I mean? It's just like, it was all stupid.
He's again, it seems like it was comedy meant for people that were that age.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work for me. But there are other good things in this film though. Like, I mean, there's stuff that works, but that part's definitely not it.
Yeah.
So if you were going to rewind and savor a part of the Manhattan Project, what would you rewind and watch over again?
I think this movie has some of the best, what would you call it, like sequences or montages I've probably ever seen in movies. And people who are trying to create a creative montage should really watch this movie, because they're fascinating to watch, stretches upon stretches of film with no dialogue whatsoever, and it is every second, every frame is completely fascinating.
Like the scenes with him putting together his homemade bomb. Yeah,
yeah, line up the lasers to like cut the hole in the wall. I mean, it was all like super duper cool.
Yeah, it's good visual storytelling for sure. I definitely thought that those were good sequences. Very very enjoyable. For me, the one sequence that I would want to watch over again is the scene where the two characters are kind of right before the standoff when John Lithgow's character comes in and sits with the boy and kind of assess the situation that the boy's in, and he admires the homemade bomb. He's like, so show me what you did there. Oh, you used this, that, or the other. And he's kind of fascinated and amused by what this kid has created. And they're kind of just sitting on the ground together talking. And it's almost like for that brief moment, it's just about the science.
Yeah, like they're both scientists. Like, they're just talking shop. Like,
yeah, like you can see like the enthusiasm of like the love of the science coming out of them. And I really like that character moment. And it's like a good little 3-minute sequence. But yep. I think it's the best moment in the entire film.
I can agree with you. Love it. I think I mentioned that earlier, but yeah, that's a great scene. And that's a scene I think that, you know, John Lithgow's character really, you know, comes up with a plan or hatches a plan, like, and figures out, like, you know, this is what it all boils down to. Then, you know, cause the scene prior, like, you know, he basically knows at that point that, you know, John Mahoney's character, the Lieutenant Colonel Conroy, is just going to shoot him, you know?
Yeah.
So, all right. So now we're going to go over the the trivia, the fun, what I call the fun stuff.
Yeah, hit me with some facts and figures, my friend.
All right, I'll go through this quickly. Fat Man and Little Boy. In real life, Paul Newman was a liberal and Dwight Schultz is a conservative. So they kind of had to play sort of opposite characters of what they were, which I thought was kind of weird. The character of Michael Merriman, John Cusack, is a fictional composite of several people and is put into the film to provide a moral compass as the common man. So, but I didn't have to tell you that, Esther. You figured that out on your own.
Well, you know, I do spend a lot of time thinking about movies.
part of the character of Michael Merriman is loosely based on scientist Lewis Slotin. Contrary to Merriman's death on the movie, I mentioned this earlier, that Slotin's accident and death occurred after dropping the two bombs on Japan. The radiation accident that happens in the movie is actually based upon both Harry Daglin and Lewis Slotin, who were killed by the same plutonium core at different times. And because of that, it became known as the Demon Core. So if you go to Wikipedia, you can look up Demon Core, and you can get a whole bunch of information on it. But they did happen after the war. Daglin, what happened to him is he dropped a tungsten carbide brick on the core, and you know that exposed the radiation. The two cores came together and you know became what they call like super critical. And so it exposes a lot of radiation, and so he died within 25 days from radiation poisoning. But about 9 months later, in May of 1946, Slotin very much died in the same way it was depicted in the film, where two beryllium cores surrounded by a plutonium core were separated by a screwdriver to keep the cups slightly apart. That particular experiment is called tickling the dragon's tail, and is usually done with wood shims. Slotin used screwdrivers, I guess, to save time. I don't know. That was the way that it was kind of depicted in the movie. Like, he had to have those numbers very quickly, so he was using screwdrivers. So when the screwdriver slipped, bringing the two halves of the core together, the mass became supercritical. Slotin dislodged the cores with his hand and succumbed to radiation poisoning 9 days later. However, the heroic action saved the lives of seven other scientists that were in the room. The Demon Core was eventually melted down for other plutonium, so I don't know what happened to it after that. The and then, you remember the musical interlude that just before the detonation? Do you remember the song?
I do. I can't like hum the tune or anything, but yeah.
It was the Nutcracker Suite, right?
The Nutcracker Suite.
So it was actually is based on a real event. So the countdown would broadcast over the radio, but due to interference from a nearby radio station, the control bunker never heard this. And the music that was played was not the Nutcracker Suite. It was Serenade for Strings by Peter Ilyich.
I wonder why they chose the Nutcracker Suite then.
So. Probably because they can get rights to it, because it's dun 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 dun, you know, and it's more probably dainty than what was being played. I don't know. Yeah. Serenade for Strings. I'll have to listen to that.
This makes me think of Christmas whenever I hear the Nutcracker. So
yeah. The filming took place in the fall of 1988, mostly outside Durango, Mexico. Where they recreated the Los Alamos Research Facility. We talked about the musical score by, how do you pronounce his name? You're better at this than me. Morricone?
I believe that's how you say it, yeah.
Yeah, he died. You got it. Yeah, he died very recently in July of 2020. And yeah, he's known for films The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, Fistful of Dollars, The Thing, The Untouchables. The budget for this film was $30 million. And it grossed $3.5 million.
It's not good. So I think people figured that out pretty quickly. And I don't know why they thought people would want to see a movie about the creation of the atomic bomb. It's not anything to be proud of, or to really. I mean, I totally get why people would not want to see it.
Yeah.
Because even when it came time to watch this, I really wanted to watch the Manhattan Project, and we needed something to pair with it. So that's why we chose this movie. I mean, really, it is. Yeah. We'll pull back the curtain of how the sausage is made here.
Yeah, a little. You know, I mean, a little bit. I mean, I remember this film more for John Cusack's character. I do remember that because I have like watched parts of it, and I've forgotten how much it focused on both of those two guys. I really did.
Memory is tricky that way.
Yeah, and, exactly. Yeah. Especially on a long movie like this. I mean,
yeah. Like, I really had to kind of get, I had to psych myself up to sit down and watch this, to be honest with you. And, you know, sometimes that works out. Sometimes the movie wins you over, because I was that way about Master and Commander. I was not looking forward to watching Master and Commander, and I ended up loving that movie.
Yeah.
So sometimes it works out. Sometimes you're surprised, like, hey, this is great.
Yeah.
But I totally get why no one wanted to see Fat Man and Little Boy. And it wasn't a good enough movie to kind of overcome that kind of hesitation.
Yeah.
So I get why it failed.
Yeah, and I'm the same way. I mean, I waited until almost the very last minute, but I was like, you know, Cusack's in this. He's such a good guy in this movie. You know, anyway.
It should have been more scenes of him dancing. I would have given it 3 stars.
I agree. I think I remember there was a scene maybe that was even cut out, because I remember there was like a scene where him and Laura Dern go to town and like go to a soda shop or something.
Hmm.
But that might have been cut out on the video. I don't. Maybe I'm recalling another movie. But anyway,
could be like a TV version. You never know.
I don't know.
TV edits exist, so you know they're typically longer. You know.
Oh, okay. Might have been. Anyway, Roger Ebert gave it 1.5 stars. He says the story behind the birth of the bomb is one of high drama, but it was largely intellectual drama, as the scientists asked themselves in conversations and nightmares, what terror were they unleashing on the Earth? Fat Man and Little Boy reduces their debates to the childish level of Hollywood stereotyping.
Yep. Very well said.
All right. Rotten Tomatoes critic score 47%, audience 45%.
So, actually higher than I expected for the audience.
It is, and higher for the critics too.
Yeah, it's not good.
I would expect the critic score to bore. I mean, I can live with the audience score being 45. I can see that. I mean, some people like the insight, even though that it is like a lot of it is dramatized, right, about the Manhattan Project. You do get kind of a sneak peek of it, I guess, or a little bit somewhat of an idea. So I can still see why that's 45%. But yeah, for the critics to be 47%, I don't really understand. A more realistic firsthand depiction of the Manhattan Project, see 1947's The Beginning or the End. It was a project of actress Donna Reed and her high school science teacher Edward R. Tompkins, who was a chemist at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Robert Oppenheimer did allow for his name to be used, and Major General Leslie Groves was hired as a consultant on the movie. There are still a few scenes that were added for dramatic effect, but the filmmakers put considerable effort into historical accuracy.
Interesting.
Yeah. The death of Oppenheimer's girlfriend, Jean Tatlock, served as a partial inspiration for the film Mulholland Falls. Did you know that?
Really?
Yeah.
I did not.
Yeah. So that movie starred in which a murder victim is found with a shard of radioactive glass in her foot. But the real Jean Tatlock had taken a non-lethal dose of chloral hydrate and was found in her apartment with her head submerged in a partially filled bathtub. And nearby was an unsigned suicide note. So there has been some speculation that it could have been, could have gone kind of either way.
Yeah.
But given that it was, that time period, it was just, kind of easier to be ruled a suicide given, her history.
Yeah, it's entirely possible that they killed her to keep Oppenheimer in line, that kind of thing. And she was a communist, and... all that kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah, that part of the movie was real, yes. And he did like break it off, and it did kind of like break her heart. But she was also like a psychologist in a very sort of man dominated field at that time. And so, yeah, she battled with like bouts of depression and stuff. So, I mean, it wasn't out of the realm of, but yeah, but that was, but because of that, like, somebody, you know, just, the writer of Mulholland Falls, it's like, oh, well, we'll just kind of rewrite a little bit of this and like come up with another story, you know?
Yeah, it's a good jumping off point for sure.
So, okay, let's move on to the Manhattan Project. I have fewer notes on it because it was just one of those, smaller budget movies, back in the 80s. The plot was influenced, by the case of John Aristotle Phillips, a Princeton University undergraduate who came to prominence in 1977 as the A-bomb kid for designing a nuclear weapon in a term paper, publicly available books and articles. So,
huh.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to know how to build an A-bomb, you could go look it up. Sounds dangerous.
Those might be like marked in the library. If you get them or something, you know what I mean?
You're going to be put on a list. Yeah.
Dr. Matthewson's line, "Fellow sons of bitches," is a reference to the original Manhattan scientist, Kenneth Bainbridge, following the first successful explosion of an atomic bomb on July 16th, 1945. Bainbridge said to fellow project scientist J. Robert Oppenheimer, quote, "Now we're all sons of bitches." So,
yeah, they kind of cursed the world, let's be honest.
After making the movie Lovesick, the director, what was his name? Brickman, what was...
Martin Brickman?
Marshall Brickman. You're close.
Marshall Brickman.
Sorry, Marshall.
No offense, sir.
So he was interested in doing something other than comedy. And he said, "Jokes are easy. I wanted the audience to feel the seductiveness of machinery." And then he said, "I became fascinated with two worlds that coexist in America. The one where the world of ordinary citizens, like the kid in the movie who has all the concomitant problem. I don't know what that word is. Concomitant? Is that a word?
I'm not sure. We are college educated people, though, ladies and gentlemen.
Those are his words.
Don't let this sell our reputation.
This is his quote, not my words.
We're leaving this in, though. No editing.
Concomitant?
Let's just move on.
Problems of adolescent sex and girls and school. Then the other world, which is the world of the military industrial complex, and within that the world. Sort of high priesthood of nuclear weapons planners and designers. So, yeah, I mean, I think he kind of succeeded in that sort of thing.
I think tone-wise and concept-wise, the movie's successful for sure.
Yeah, the producers held an actual science fair at the New York Penta Hotel, paying $75 each to actual students from the tri-state area who participated in the science fair and contributed their own individually created projects.
We're gonna get through this, Ryan.
I don't do this for a living.
Hang on, we're gonna get there, Ryan. We're gonna get there. It'll be all right. I can't lose you now, man. We're almost at the finish line.
My mouth is dry. Hold on. Dr. Pepper. That is not a product placement. We are not sponsored by Dr. Pepper.
God, I wish we had Dr. Pepper money.
All right. Let's see. Where were we at? So, yeah.
Paying
so that,
kids
well,
the, science
yeah,
fair.
The science fair. So, the, I mean, not the kids that were there, but the science fair. That was a real science fair that was going on, basically.
It definitely looked real.
Marshall Brickman received the. Oh, wait. The special effects team used tons of technical gear purchased from the. Surplus from the Los Alamos National Laboratories.
Interesting. So yeah. It was authentic equipment.
Yeah, so it's another tie-in to the real Manhattan Project. Marshall Bergman received the President's Award from the Academy of Science Fiction and Fantasy Horror Films for the Manhattan Project. And, however, Brickman did not direct again until the 2001 Showtime television movie Sister Mary Explains It All.
Yeah, his career is pretty brief. Mm-hmm. And who knows why that is. I mean, Manhattan Project is a pretty well-directed movie, so I don't know why he didn't really do anything else. But yeah, he didn't really do much else.
In the role of Ginny, Cynthia Nixon was nominated for the Young Artist Award by the Young Artist Foundation in the category of Exceptional Performance by a Young Actress Supporting Role.
I don't know. That sounds made up. But okay.
She lost. Wait till you hear who she lost to, okay?
Okay.
She lost to Jenny James in a movie called Papa Was a Preacher. It doesn't even have a Wikipedia page, for God's sakes.
I feel like this is some sort of weird Mandela effect thing where this came from a world where that award and that movie's a thing.
If you look up Papa, it's not in this reality. If you look up Papa as a Preacher, it is a novel from the 1940s that, yes, was turned into a movie in 1985, but I had to dig for that information.
Yeah.
I didn't even know who Jenny James was. Anyway.
It doesn't ring a bell for me.
But you know who else was also up for that award?
Who's that?
Carrie Henn in Aliens.
Who I've met Carrie Henn. She's a very nice lady.
Oh.
She teaches school now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I met her. I used to work as a vendor at science fiction conventions, mm-hmm. and she was a regular guest at some of them.
Oh, awesome!
So yeah, I've got some photos with her and an autograph. You know. She's a nice lady. She was a school, but like I said, she's a school teacher now.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, she also lost to Jenny James.
Yeah, that's so weird.
Anyway, Roger Ebert gave the Manhattan Project. You want to guess?
I'm going to guess. He does a 4-star scale.
Yep.
So I will guess he gave it 2 stars.
He gave it 4 stars.
Really?
Yes. And he says, yeah,
it's pretty good.
Yeah, you have to remember, like you said, smug kid, that's what adults think that kids are, right? So anyway, he says, quote, a clever, funny, and skillful thriller that stays close as possible to the everyday lives of convincing people so that the movie's frightening aspects are convincing.
Yeah, that sums it up well.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, well, it could be. So, I mean... Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, it's not so far fetched that it, I guess, couldn't happen. Is what he's trying to say, and the you know it's like real, you know, real world, America, like atomic bomb, like being built in your backyard kind of thing. The Rotten Tomatoes score, critics 50%, audience 46%.
See, I found that surprising. It's perfectly entertaining film. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's enjoyable.
How many, I mean, out of 5 stars, what would you give it?
Me personally, I gave it 2.5.
You gave it 2.5, okay.
That's average, you know, I mean, average, you know, it's got some good points and some bad points. You know? But to me, most films are average.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair. I mean, if I was going through my Netflix, like, star rating, I'd probably give it 3 stars.
And there, but that's only a half star difference if you think about it.
Yeah, it's so, true. It's true. But I liked it more than Fat Man and Little Boy.
That's for sure. It is a much better film than that.
Yeah. Like I said, I mean, I watched it over and over again when I was a kid. Because I mean, it is true. I mean, to you know, high school kids where they're shown as not being you know, goofballs, you know, where they're actually smart and intelligent and kind of can one-up, you know, adults in some things, you know, always says a lot when you're younger, I guess, especially a smart, intelligent film, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's definitely meant to appeal to people in that age range, for sure.
Yeah. So, movie suggestions, right?
Yeah, so do you have any movie recommendations to go along with these two?
Movie recommendations, I think you know, if somebody really liked Fat Man and Little Boy, I mean, you can always watch The Hunt for Red October, I guess. But I think for like the Manhattan Project, I kept going back to like War Games. I mean, I hate to pick like a popular title, but I think War Games to me like says more about, you know, detente and where they were politically. And even though that it's a movie, like I said, that kind of is about computers and fascinating about computers and computers sort of taking over our, you know, artificial intelligence sort of taking over our, you know, defense decisions. It does sort of open up a dialogue about that. And I think that like speaks in a more like dramatic way, I guess you would say. And I think it's just a fascinating, you know, because it starts off the same way where the kid's like kind of doing something, playing around, you know, kind of playing with fire and doesn't really know like where it's going.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know what, I think it'd be a good idea to look at War Games in depth. Maybe next time?
Yeah. Do another watch along?
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah. I mean, how long has it been since you've seen War Games?
I mean, personally, it's probably been 15 years.
Really?
Yeah.
God. I've probably seen it, like, I probably saw it a couple years ago. I am a War Games, like, nerd. I've seen War Games 2, which I will probably claim doesn't exist. Because it's more like a sci-fi made-for-TV movie or something. But where, like, the Whopper is, like, you know, in being used for like bank transactions or something like that's really weird. Like in Canada or something like that. I can't remember. It's really odd. But anyway,
let's save that for next time. I definitely want to hear more about that.
No, you don't. You don't want to hear about War Games 2. You really don't.
I've got some morbid curiosity about it now. I don't want to watch it. But I want to hear you tell me about it.
Yeah. It's one of those movies. Like, I rarely watch, like, a lot of movies, and I rarely watch movies with, you know, director's commentary and things. And I definitely watched that movie's director's commentary, like, probably more than once. So
for my recommendation, you know, I thought about this for a while, because there are a lot of things we mentioned, like, that tonally kind of are similar to both these films. But I was thinking about it. So much of what this was all about is how we as Americans and American audience kind of, you know, cope with the idea of living in the shadow of this creation. You know, how we've kind of come to terms with the idea that we live in the post-atomic age. And I think that the movie I would recommend to go along with that to show another side of it is how the post-atomic age affected the people who the bomb was actually dropped on, which is the people of Japan. Because that's what we use movies for. We use pop culture to interpret and grow and explain our feelings. And their fears and their horrors about what happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki were kind of interpreted and funneled through a legendary science fiction film that we all know, but I'm going to say now, it's the original Godzilla, the black and white version, which is available from Criterion. You can watch it on, I think, HBO Max and the Criterion streaming channel. And it's fascinating to see how they took their fear and their trauma from surviving the true atomic blast and kind of funneled it into this all-time great science fiction creation that started off as a horror, but now is almost like a mascot and a symbol of you know, joy in Japan. To me, that's fascinating, and it all starts with that original film.
Well, you know, I never even thought about that and what, you know, Godzilla sort of symbolized for the Japanese people. And, you know, that is really, really amazing. And, I mean, I just, I never even, you know, never even would cross my mind to, you know, connect those things together. You know, because I was, you know, I was much too young when, you know, I wasn't even born when all these things happened. And it's hard to, you know, retrace our steps of history and in culture and to learn that. So, you know, thank you very much for, you know, for sharing that. And I'm going to look at Godzilla in a completely, completely different way just from you saying that, like, because it is so much a part of movie culture around the world. Completely. So, thank you, Matt, for bringing up that suggestion. I think that's really, really awesome. And I think that's going to about do it for our show, for Bombs Away, for the atomic bomb. So thank you very much, listeners. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Esrie. Go watch some movies, guys.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at VideoCulture2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us and let's all watch movies together.
It's a brilliant achievement.
He'd get the Nobel if he could publish.
Publish?
I said if.
All right, set him up. Someplace quiet, away from prying eyes.
Paul, come say hi. Dr. Matheson, this is my son, Paul.
He's hot for my mother. He figures I'm a dumb kid.
He's hot for your mother, really?
Uh-huh. He's got all these security clearances. I don't know what they are. Los Alamos, Oak Ridge.
What is that?
What does it look like?
A five-leaf clover. Where'd you find it?
Growing outside that lab. You know the odds on that kind of mutation happening naturally without chemicals or radiation or something? It's like 1,000,000,000 to 1. It never happens.
Maybe you're just very lucky. Who knows about this?
Just us.
We should do something.
We can get in there. What can they do to us anyway? We're kids. It's a prank, right?
A and B Carter just both went at once.
What's happening?
It's Paul.
Hate to go in there, Charlie. They got stuff in there that zaps you right out.
Any idea who he's working with?
I don't think he's working with anybody. I think he did it by himself.
Who are these people?
Does he feel that people don't like him?
That he's special or different?
Is he unhappy with the present political system?
They can't do anything to me.
Why not?
I'm underage.
What do you think this is, a school play? You could start a war, for God's sake. Stop screwing around before it's too late.
The package has arrived, and it's hot.
You don't know what you took, Paul.
I do not want them off the premises with that gadget, do you copy?
Give me a clear shot behind the ear, and I'll turn them off like a switch.